Brett here. Before we get to the show, quick heads up. I have changed the theme music for the Art of Manliness podcast. Now, I've been wanting to do this for a few months, a couple reasons why. One reason, we did a whole redesign of the Art of Manliness back in January, where we went from like that Victorian feel to a more 1970s, 80s vibe. So I wanted some podcast music to fit that branding, quote unquote. Also, over the years, I've gotten complaints about the current music, those blaring horns, the bam, bam, bam. I guess when you're wearing earbuds, it's not very pleasant. Also, just really harsh sounding. So I've been wanting to change it for that reason as well. So after months of listening to hundreds of tracks, hours, just mind-numbing surfing, looking through and listening to the stuff, I found it. The new intro music, the Art of Manliness podcast. I was going for like something like Kojak, Streets of San Francisco vibe, where it's smooth but has a driving edge. This is it. So without further ado, world debut of the new AOM podcast intro music. It's called Soul Jazz. I like it. I hope you like it too. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Now, when you ask people about their schedules, they'll typically tell you about how they're very busy and don't have enough time for sleep or for leisure activities. Yet, when they're actually asked to track their time, it turns out they work less and sleep more than they realize. My guest today studied and dug into this disparity. Her name is Laura Vanderkam, and she's the author of several books on the personal use of time, including the focus of our discussion today. It's called Off the Clock, Feel Less Busy While Getting More Done. Today on the show, Laura and I discuss why there's a gap between how busy people think they are versus how busy they actually are. We then unpack what the people who don't feel oppressed by the phantom of busyness do differently than those who do, why time goes by faster when you're older than it did when you were young, and how you can still slow down time as an adult. We talk about how what you really want are more memories, not more time, and how to find more adventure in your ordinary life. We end our conversation discussing how tracking your time can create a more memorable life, why you need to create open spaces in your schedule, and the one tactic you can begin doing this week to start making more of your time. After the show's over, check out our show notes at aom.io/off the clock. Laura joins me now via clearcast.io. All right, Laura Vanderkam, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've made a career for yourself researching and writing about how people spend their time. For example, you've written a lot of best-selling books like, you know, What the Most Successful People Do Before Breakfast, 168 Hours. Now you're at this new book, Off the Clock, Feel Less Busy While Getting More Done. How'd you end up doing what you're doing, like researching and writing about how people spend their time?
Well, it's been a long time in coming in. And it was not a straightforward story of like I knew growing up I wanted to write about time. But I did realize something that seems, you know, obvious in retrospect, but at the time was profound and sort of shaped all my writing on it, which is that we all have the same amount of time. Like, I find this such an incredible thing. You know, some people have more money or more naturally talented at whatever else than the rest of us may be, but we all have the same amount of time. And so since our lives are lived in hours, we all have access to the exact same building blocks to create the lives we want. And I just find that so fascinating. And also this reality that how we think we spend our time is often not how we actually spend our time. And I'm fascinated by topics where I think the prevailing wisdom is wrong. I don't think people are increasingly busy, increasingly sleep deprived or anything like that. So I find that interesting too.
Well, let's get into that. So you've done a lot of these time surveys. Well, you'll get a whole bunch of people to start tracking their time meticulously because they haven't before. And they'll say, oh, I'm just so busy. I never have time for anything. But then you have them actually track their time. So let's do this. First off, let's look at the surveys before people track their time. Like what do the surveys say about people in what you call time stress, like that feeling you don't have any time? What are the general trends there?
Well, you know, lots of people say that they have intense time stress. I mean, certainly majorities will answer Gallup's poll saying, you know, do you have time for the things that you want to do? And most people say, no, I don't. And it's more pronounced, of course, among people who have full-time jobs, or people who have children at home, and people who have both of those are, of course, in the most time-crunched category. You know, people have always thought that they are busier than anyone else at any other time in human history. It's kind of funny because I collect old magazines, like old copies of Fortune magazine from the 1950s. And there was one particularly funny article I remember as a survey of businessmen about the state of everything. And at the time, you know, marginal tax rates were quite high. And so the question, the policy question out there was like, well, if tax rates are lower, will people work more? And the businessmen were like, well, we'd like lower taxes, but how could we possibly be working more? You know, it doesn't even seem, you know, that there are more hours we could be working more, you know? So of course now people would say the same thing too, that how could I possibly be working anymore? So people have kind of always felt that way.
So but there's a difference between feeling like you don't have enough time and actually not having time. So what do these time diary studies that you've done, what do they say about how people are actually spending their time?
Yeah, so I first came across this idea of a time diary study when I came across the American Time Use Survey, which is this fantastic study that the Bureau of Labor Statistics does annually, where they call up thousands of Americans rolling over the whole year, so any day of the year, and they basically ask you to talk through yesterday. So there's no question like, what's a typical day? What does a normal day in your life look like? Or how much do you sleep on a typical night? Or any question like that that can be very misleading. They just have you talk through yesterday. And then they average all these things and they get a picture of American life. And I was looking at the survey for the first time a couple of years ago, and I'm like, wait, you mean the average American sleeps more than 8 hours a day? And in fact, that's true. You know, when you actually have people recount yesterday, as opposed to some day that we've got stuck in our minds as a typical day. And so, you know, I found this utterly fascinating. So I've decided to start doing my own time diary studies. So for several of my books, I've recruited big numbers of people to track their time, either for a day or a week, depending on the methodology I was doing, and then to answer questions about their lives. And, you know, you find some fascinating things. There's quite a gap between perception of where the time goes and reality, certainly on aspects of how much we sleep, how much we work, how much time we devote to things like housework, how much free time we have, all those kinds of things.
Well, let's talk about those discrepancies. So like what, like when you ask people before you do the survey, like, well, you know, how on average, how often, how many hours a week do you work? What do they say? Or like when they say, oh, how many on average, how many hours of sleep do you get a night? What do they say? And then what are the actual results typically?
Yeah, I've definitely had people say, oh, you know, I work about 60 hours a week, and then I have them track their time and it's like 42. And now the 42 is a very long week, by the way. I mean, because that's besides lunch, you know, breaks you take during the day, or if you, you know, come in late because of a traffic jam, or you have to jet out early for a dentist appointment or something, you know. So 42 hours is quite a long work week. It's also not 60. But what's happening is that we tend to remember our longest days or our longest weeks as typical. And I'm sure that person has, in fact, worked 60 hours at some point during their life of a week, but or that they've worked 12 hours on some day. And so they're remembering that day and multiplying by five. But it's probably not typical. Same thing with sleep. We tend to do in the opposite direction. We tend to remember our worst nights as typical, largely because it really stinks not to sleep. I mean, you know, we all know that. So negative things tend to stand out in the mind. But when you have people track the whole of their time, you get different results. So I had for one of my books a couple of years ago, and I was looking particularly at women who had big jobs and also had kids. So, you know, working mothers, there's definitely the story out here of like, oh, you know, you never sleep, right? There's a quote of like, these people talk about sleep the way a starving man talks about food. And yet I found that 90% of the people I studied averaged at least 7 hours a day over the course of the week. You know, so that's pretty good.
It is really good. And there's been also some other interesting things that come out of this. Like, you know, a lot of people, there's like all these alarmist things going on that people aren't spending enough time with their kids a day because they're so busy with work and other activities. But surveys show that people actually spend more time with their kids now than parents did in the 1950s or 60s, when it was supposed to be sort of like when that was the age when parents did lots of stuff with kids.
Yeah, it turns out they really didn't. I mean, I don't know. We have faulty memories of this. Yeah, you know, some of it's just differences in parenting. People were more likely to just sort of send their kids out on their bikes all day and, you know, collect them when it got dark, and that was acceptable. And a lot of people just don't do that anymore. So the kids are around their parents more just because of that. But yeah, interactive time has risen both for men and women. And it makes sense probably for men if we sort of have the image of a 1950s dad who didn't even know how to change diapers. Well, clearly, you know, most fathers would be appalled at that idea now. And so we understand that that number would probably have gone up. But it turns out it's gone up for women too, even as the vast majority of women are now in the workforce.
Were there any results from your time diary studies that surprised you, like you weren't expecting at all?
Well, I was very excited about the sleep one because it just, you know, you hear this all the time that if you're going to build a career and raise a family, you will never sleep again. And I think that it's really important to tell people that's not true. Like, yes, there's going to be bad nights. And, you know, if you have a kid who's under like a year old, yes, there's going to be more interrupted nights, but children only spend a few years being in the baby stage. Even if you have multiple children, you only spend a few years in the baby stage. So it does get better for the most part. You know, one thing that was interesting is that parents do have leisure time. It probably doesn't tend to show up as a day at the spa, but there's often some time after kids go to bed or on weekends, you know, where the kids are occupied with other things or you're trading off with your spouse. So there is some time that can be used. And I think that was an exciting thing to find as well.
Well, another thing you uncovered in your surveys is that, you know, because a lot of people felt like they didn't have any time. They had that time stress, but they actually did have time when they tracked it. But there was a group of people that you uncovered that they didn't feel pressed for time. They actually felt pretty calm and relaxed. So like what separated those people who like had an accurate perception of what the time available they had compared to the other people who felt really stressed out about a time, but they shouldn't have been stressed out in the first place?
Well, there's a couple things that were different. So, you know, for this book, Off the Clock, I had 900 people track their time for a day. And then I asked them questions about how they felt about their time. And there were a couple of, you know, I could assign people a score. People had high time perception scores, felt like time was generally abundant. People had low time perception scores, felt like they were stressed or starved for time. And there were a couple of differences. You know, one, the people who felt more like time was abundant actually had a better sense of where their time went. Like they could fill out the survey easier. I mean, that was one thing right there. So being mindful of your time is probably the first step. And they were also somewhat counterintuitively more likely to do quite interesting things on the March Monday that I had them track. So people in my top group were doing such interesting things on a Monday night as like going to salsa dancing lessons or going to a big band concert or taking their family to a movie on a Monday night, which, you know, I think a lot of people are like, wait, that's like not a Monday night activity, you know, but by doing memorable things, they became in their minds the kind of person who has the time to do these sorts of things. They were more likely to spend their leisure time interacting with friends and family. They were less likely to spend their leisure time watching TV or on social media. And in general, they checked their phones less frequently than the people who felt starved for time. And it's certainly not like they were monks about it. Like, I mean, everyone was checking at least hourly. So like, you know, not to claim that people were those sort of magical sorts who managed to check their phones once a day. But there's a big difference between checking once an hour and checking like 20 times an hour in terms of how we perceive our time.
Well, we'll unpack some of these things that these folks did a little bit more. But what I also like about your book, Off the Clock, you kind of get in the psychology of time because it's really weird. There's a really weird psychological thing going on how we perceive time. So sometimes in our life, we perceive like time going really slow. And other times, like it seems like it's going by really fast. You're like, oh my gosh, it was just, you know, February. It was just January a week ago, but it was actually 2 months ago. So like what goes on there where it feels like time slows down? It feels like we have all the time in the world, but other times it feels like time's just going by. It's like a blur.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because there's slow good and there's slow bad. And many of us have been in the unfortunate situation where time appears to be going very slowly, but not in a good way. Like your kid is screaming on a cross-country flight. It feels like 5 hours. You are paying for it in second-long increments. Or if you're stuck in an incredibly boring meeting or you're in a traffic jam or something like that, these are very painful slow moments. But the question, right, you know, is it possible to make good moments seem to pass as slowly as these bad moments? And on one level, no. But there are certain interesting things, as you said, with time perception. And one is that the more memories we have of any given unit of time, the longer it seems. So for most people, for instance, the 4 years of high school or the 4 years of college seem actually quite a bit longer than the previous 4 years of your life, because you had more memories of those times. You know, what makes a memory? Well, doing something for the first time or something being very emotionally intense. And we go through a lot more of those sort of emotionally intense experiences as young people when we're kind of figuring out the world. Or even just if you think about, you know, going on a vacation somewhere exotic, like the first day, it feels incredibly long. And what's going on is it's all new. And your brain has absolutely no idea what it's going to need to remember in the future. So it's remembering all of it. And that makes time seem more vast. Whereas like getting up and getting ready and going to work 2 days ago, you probably have absolutely no memory of that whatsoever, because it was the exact same thing you've done every day for the past however many years. And so your brain, being very utilitarian, decides that it has no reason to hold on to the memory of doing this. And so it's just gone. This time is completely disappeared into a memory sinkhole. And what makes sort of those weeks and years race by then is when we have kind of too many of those memory sinkholes, when, you know, weeks and months of sameness stack up, where there's nothing new, there's nothing emotionally intense, then you don't remember it. And you wind up being that person who's saying to some kid you haven't seen in 3 years, "Oh my goodness, look how much you've grown," because it didn't seem like 3 years to you.
Yeah. The analogy that I've heard used to describe when we experience something new and why looking back on it seems like it lasted a long time, it's like slow motion footage on a camera, right? In order to get that slow motion footage, the camera has to take lots and lots of frames per second. So it has a lot of footage there. So your brain does something similar when something new happens, like you said, because it doesn't know what the stuff it needs to remember or not remember. So it just takes a whole bunch of quote unquote footage, and then you play it back and it's slow motion in your mind.
Yeah, I think that's a great analogy, that it is taking in a lot of this new stuff, this different stuff, this uncertain stuff, and then that becomes a stronger memory than sort of everyday sameness.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. Spring is here and the McKays are going to be really busy. I'm coaching flag football again. My daughter's playing basketball. And on those nights when we don't have time to cook a full meal and clean up, we like to eat Factor meals. Factor meals are ready-to-eat meals that are on the table in less than 2 minutes. They're fresh, they're not frozen, they're chef-crafted and dietitian approved. You eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. You just simply heat and savor the good stuff. And all these meals are really, really nutritious. They're macro-friendly if you're tracking your macros. That's another reason why I like them. So we've been using Factor meals for a while. One thing I've enjoyed lately is the green chili chicken. Super tasty. I also like the creamy mushroom chicken and rice. Very good. It also comes with garlic green beans. And again, you just warm these things up in 2 minutes, and then you have this really delicious meal. And best of all, cleanup's a breeze. If you want to try this out, head to factormeals.com/manliness50 and use code manliness50, that's manliness50, to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's a good deal. That's code manliness50, manliness50 at factormeals.com/manliness50. Get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Check it out today. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness.
Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, M-A-N-L-I-N-E-S-S. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So for example, you can learn the art of negotiation from Chris Voss. We had him on the podcast. Leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest. Writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest. You name it, Masterclass has it. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. masterclass.com/AOM. Check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss. And now back to the show. So let's get to this idea, some of the tactics that you got from the people who didn't feel time stress. And we've been talking about these memories. And I thought you quoted this person. It was Lila Devachi. Is that how you say her name? Professor. She's a college.
Something like that. Yeah.
Psychology professor Lila Devachi says that when a lot of people, when they say we want more time, what we really want is more memories.
Yeah. And I would add to that, that we want more time that we feel good about. Like nobody wants more time in the middle of a kid temper tantrum. Like nobody wants more time in a traffic jam or in an extremely boring meeting or when you're like physically uncomfortable in some way. These are not, you know, times that we want more time. We want more time that we are happy about. And her point with the memories is just you want more time that you've done things that you look back on fondly. You want a richer life is what you want. And so these things are all interrelated.
And I love this idea you put out there to unpack this idea even more, is that a useful way to get more memories is think of ourselves as three people. So there's like the past self, present self, and future self. So how can thinking about us as three people help us, I don't know, provide like a mindset to, you know, take more memories in?
Yeah, well, if you think about where your kind of mental script is going, we're all carrying on some sort of conversation in our brains constantly. If you ever pause and think about what you are thinking about in any given moment, you're either where you are now in the present, or you are looking forward to the future, or you are thinking about something that happened in the past. And these three selves are all part of our identity. And the issue, though, for our needing to create memories and do novel and intense things is I found this great quote from a philosopher that we pamper the present like a spoiled child. And so in your mind, you may be the kind of person who would love to go to a cool art exhibit after work someday and you know, go to this museum with evening hours and see the stuff. And maybe there's a band that's playing it there. It sounds awesome. But then, you know, after work, well, you're tired. And it's raining and your couch looks really inviting. So you're like, oh, well, you know, I don't have to do that. And it's like, well, okay, that's true. But when we give in too much to the present, to the experiencing self, and don't think about what the anticipating self wanted to do or what the remembering self will have been happy to have done, then we wind up doing nothing. And then, as we said, you know, these years disappear into memory sinkholes. So, you know, I try to remember, and I encourage other people to try to think, you know, whenever you are listening to the current present experiencing self, remind yourself that this is just one actor trying to carry out a monologue in what should be a three-actor play. And if you thought something sounded really cool and you think you will have been happy to have done it afterwards, like, just go do it. Yes, you may be tired, but I don't know about you, but you know, between the career and the kids, I could always be tired, right? Like, I mean, the fact that you're tired does not in and of itself mean you shouldn't do something. And we tend to draw energy from meaningful things.
And I like the imagery you had of like, you know, think of like putting like a treasure in a chest for your future self to look back on. He can go through and rummage through all the memories. Like you're doing that now. And so like, think about like, what kind of stuff do you want to find in that box when you're like 70 or 80 years old?
Yeah, because if you don't put it in there, it will never be in there. I mean, I guess you could try to create fake memories after the fact, but I think it's more fun if they were there in the first place.
And so this is easy. You don't have to go on an exotic trip. It could just be you go to the museum after work, or you take the kids to a movie on a Monday night.
Yeah, it really doesn't have to be profound. And so the things I saw in my time diary study were highly likely to be those kinds of adventures. I mean, you know, probably somebody wasn't taking my survey if they were in Tahiti. Not that you shouldn't go to Tahiti, but, you know, again, those are more once in a lifetime type experiences. You can create adventure out of your normal life, but you have to think about doing it. And sometimes you have to nudge yourself a little bit over that initial resistance.
Yeah, we had a guest on the podcast a while back ago, Alistair Humphreys. He's an adventurer, like a professional adventurer, but he wrote this book called Micro Adventures, talking about just taking little small adventures in your backyard. And it could be something as simple as like spending the night in your backyard with your kids in a sleeping bag out in the stars. That's it. That could be a great memory.
Yeah. No, that's so true. And it might help to make a list, and maybe it's about consulting a book like that of Micro Adventures, or looking at things that are cool to do within 2 hours of your house, right? I mean, even if you're not in a particularly great touristy area, probably if you give yourself a 2-hour radius, which you could drive to on a weekend, there's a reasonable amount of fun stuff and adventurous stuff you could do. And, you know, ask your kids, ask your partner what they'd like to do. And you can start pulling things off this list and attempt to create, you know, little adventures in your life. Maybe daily doesn't work, but, you know, twice a week probably could.
Yeah, definitely. So let's talk about this idea of being mindful of your time. So I imagine that just involves tracking your time. Is that all it is to become mindful of your time? Just tracking it, sort of like tracking your food or tracking your money?
Well, I certainly recommend tracking your time. I mean, there's other ways. You can sort of reflect on your day and look forward to your next day without really filling out a spreadsheet, which is what I do. But I'm a huge fan of time tracking. I've actually been tracking my time continuously for about 4 years now, which I know makes me sound like just a ton of fun. But it's partly about having these cemented memories for me, because I have spreadsheets outlining how I spent the 168 hours of every week since April 2015. And if I pull up one of those spreadsheets and look at a day, I say, oh yeah, that. And then the memory is there. Whereas, you know, I think most of us just think about it, like, what did you do on July 16, 2017? Well, I'm guessing you have no clue. I mean, if you got married or one of your kids was born on that day, you do. But for most of us, we don't. And so my time tracking has really helped with that. So I'm mindful of my time as it's going because I'm recording it. So I'm accountable for it. And then I'm mindful of it in the past because I can look back on these spreadsheets and see where it has gone.
So, I mean, I can see tracking being easy when you're like tracking like work time or like here's kid time. But like, what about those like moments where you're just like, you know, you're passing through the kitchen and you pick up the dumb magazine you get and you flip through a few pages? Like, how do you track that small stuff like that?
Well, the honest truth is it's hard to capture all of that. And so my system is certainly not perfect. I know some people attempt to get everything, but it can be very, very difficult. And you want to make sure that you're achieving a right balance between capturing stuff and being able to actually complete a log. So I track in half-hour blocks. My spreadsheet has the days of the week across the top running from Monday to Sunday, and then half-hour blocks going down the left-hand side from 5 a.m. to 4:30 a.m. And I check in like 3 to 4 times a day and write what I've done since the last time. So no, it's not going to be perfect. I think it's about 90% there. It's not going to capture if I'm paging through a magazine, but it will, you know, I try to put slashes through to say what stuff is. Like it might be, you know, laundry / read / kids. Like that will be an entry for what I was spending half an hour doing. Because the point, again, is not to create a perfect pie chart with mutually exclusive and comprehensively exhaustive categories. It's more, can you get a good picture of your life? And the thing with my time logs, it's close enough. I can see, you know, I'm probably working more like 35 to 40 hours a week, not 50 to 60 in general. I can see that in general, I sleep somewhere between 7 and 7.5 hours a day. I can see I spend about an hour a day in the car. I can see I spend about an hour a day reading. I see I spend on average about 1/2 hour a day exercising. So, you know, these are the things that I get the parameters of my life over time.
Well, this leads to another point you make in the book about another way to free up more time or make it feel like you have more time is like, don't try to over-optimize your life. And sometimes you just got to accept, you know, good enough, and that's okay.
I am a big fan of good enough. Like, you know, perfect is definitely overrated.
So another thing you found with these folks who didn't feel pressed for time is they had a lot of open space, and you found on their calendar. They had a lot of open space on their calendar. And some of these people like were incredibly busy. They're, you know, high power CEOs, but you when you emailed them or called them and asked for a meeting, they're just like, oh yeah, just come anytime, whatever works for you. And that's kind of, you're like, wait a minute, these people, their calendar should be just be booked nonstop. But that wasn't the case.
Yeah, I think most of us are walking around with this story kind of unquestioned that the more important you are, the busier you are. You know, like being busy is a sign that you are important. And while it makes sense because people who are important have a big demand for their time, that's why they're important, right? These things follow. It doesn't follow that they naturally pack every minute of their day. And I found that many of these people use the power they have over their time to consciously leave open space, you know, for a couple of reasons. I mean, one, it's practical. Like, you know, if you picture yourself having meetings stacked up every half hour through the day and one runs over, which it inevitably will because something will happen, the person will be late, you'll get into an argument about something and have to keep going with it. Like, the rest of the day is just messed up. It falls over like dominoes. And whereas if you have open space, you can get caught up. But it's also about being, you know, able to seize opportunity. Like, if you're having a really good conversation with someone and you're coming up with great ideas, it's really awesome to be able to stick with it and not have to be like, yeah, I got to go, you know, racing off to this other meeting that's, I don't know, about something like office fridge policies or something pointless. But this is what people do when things are scheduled on their calendar for a certain time. They naturally wind up rising up the hierarchy of importance, even if they're not important at all. So I think, you know, people who are smart about their time are very, very careful about that. And it's hard to keep open space. Like if people are asking for your time, A, it's flattering. Like B, you might want to talk to them, you know, and C, like you say, well, I'm free, like I should. But it's, you know, open space is not nothing. Open space is often where people get their best ideas. It's where they deal with whatever is most pressing in the moment. It is where they get ready for future crises that might happen. It's where they invest in the relationships, particularly at work, in those open spaces. So open space is productive, and any given meeting isn't necessarily.
So I imagine the way you avoid, you say, so here's what I imagine is happening. You track your time, you can see opportunities where you can create open space in your calendar because you realize, well, I'm not really doing much from this hour to this hour, so I can leave that open. But the trick to keeping it white, that space white, is like just telling people, sorry, got something going on at that time, can't do it then, if they want to do something at that time.
Yeah, that's certainly one thing you can say. You know, I think it's people need to get more comfortable with not doing stuff and saying this isn't the best use of my time. And that may not be the phrase you use to someone. You may suggest they do something else or say, well, you know, we could probably, you know, take this in a 5-minute phone call as opposed to a 60-minute meeting. But in general in life, I encourage people when somebody asks you to do something and you're asked to do it in the future, your question should not be like, am I free at that day in the future? Because that's the wrong question. Like the best question to ask yourself before you say yes is, would I do this thing tomorrow? Because we understand the opportunity cost for tomorrow in a way that we just can't see for the future. Like we understand how much we have going on. We understand how we'll feel for tomorrow. So, you know, if you say yes for tomorrow, like you'd cancel things in your schedule, you'd move stuff around to take on whatever somebody's asking you to do in the future, then you'll be excited in the future too. So you should definitely say yes. But, you know, if you would have no qualms about saying no to this thing for tomorrow, then probably you should say no to it in the future as well.
Yeah, that tip, that took me, like I learned that on my own. It took a while because like I would make these commitments that were months out. I'm like, oh yeah, not a problem. And then the thing finally came, like a speaking engagement or something. But then like my life was just crazy then. I'm like, oh my gosh, why did I say yes to this thing? I can't believe I did this. So yeah, that advice, if being thinking about if I were to do this tomorrow, would I say yes? And typically the answer is no.
Yeah. This fallacy, we're like, oh, it'll never be July. I mean, right. Yes, it will be. It will be July. And you'll be the same person you are now.
So you also talk about people who don't feel pressed for time is that they invest their time in people. This is sort of like similar to the idea that with your money, the way you can get the most out of your money is if you spend it in experiences. So I imagine is the same thing holds true for time?
Pretty much. Investing in our relationships is one of the best ways we can spend time, both in terms of feeling like we have more time and feeling more relaxed about time and being happier about our time.
And what happens if like those relationships start draining you? Like then like it starts feeling slow and like these are not good memories?
Well, then that's probably not the right relationship to be investing that time in. And you know, here's the hard truth is we do have to be choosy about these things. Time is, time is finite. The expectations are probably infinite. I mean, there are a lot of people in this world. You can't be close friends with all of them. But if some relationship is energizing to you, then it is definitely worth investing more in that, even if it's not terribly convenient. It doesn't have to be a huge amount of people. You know, I think for most people, between their spouse or, you know, partner, maybe one or two other close relatives, two or three friends, like that may be as much as you can actually handle with really investing in those relationships. But on the other hand, you know, if you have a handful of people, even, you know, under 10, but who are really, really close with you, that can take you a long ways.
So we've been talking a lot of different tactics and things you can use, mindsets you can use to feel like you have more time. But like, is there like one thing you think someone can start doing today that will provide a lot of, you know, ROI and that in feeling like they have more off the clock time?
Well, I think one of the best things you can do is a Friday afternoon planning session. And I do this and it's really helped me with my time. Every Friday afternoon, I sit down and I list my priorities for the next week. I list them in three categories, career, relationships, and self. So what are the top two or three things I want to do in each of these categories over the course of the next week? And then I look at my calendar and I sort of figure out roughly where they're going to happen. Hopefully they're already on my calendar. Like sometimes I've already put stuff on in the past that I've thought would be a good idea. And that's great. But if not, I say like, oh, well, I'd like to get together with a friend at some point this week for a run. How can I make that happen? Or I'd like to do something with my husband this week. How can we make that happen? Or, you know, one of my kids seems especially like he or she would need something. Let me try and make some special time with that person. Okay. So those all go on the calendar, top priority stuff. And then look at the calendar, see what's already on there for the next week and start triaging, you know, ask yourself what you don't want to do and if it has to happen. Because if you are going to cancel something, it's really much nicer to do it ahead of time so everyone can make other plans. Or you might see that you're meeting with someone and you don't really think it's the best use of anyone's time. Like maybe it could just become a phone call if it was supposed to be a meeting, or maybe it's scheduled for 60 minutes, but you see no possible reason that this needs to take 60 minutes. So that's when you send around the question, oh, I really want to be clear on this agenda, right? And if the agenda doesn't fill 60 minutes, you knock it down. Or, you know, maybe it's that you're delegating something, somebody else can take something on for you. But you do this at work, you can do this at home, you know, with your activities as well. And then, you know, you hopefully can open up hours with doing these things. But even if you can't, you've also put in the good stuff with your priorities. So if the good stuff is there, the bad stuff tends to either feel like it takes less time or actually takes less time.
So I mean, what I like about this stuff, it doesn't take much time or energy to do this either.
No. And I don't know about you, but I'm really not doing much on Friday afternoon in the first place. Like, you know, it's so hard to start anything new at that point. So I'm really just more in future planning mode by that point.
Well, Laura, where can people go to learn more about your work?
So I'd love if people would come visit my website, lauravanderkam.com. You can, you know, read about the book Off the Clock that we were talking about. I also have a new book coming out in March called Juliet's School of Possibilities, which is a time management fable. So hopefully some of your listeners will check that out as well.
And also at your website, you have the time log sheets that people can download and use for themselves, right?
Yeah, I definitely do. You can fill out the form on my website to be emailed a time log and a time management guide. But, you know, you can also just make your own spreadsheet. It's really nothing fancy, I promise. But you can track time other ways too. I mean, there's dozens of commercial time tracking apps on the market. I mean, you can walk around with a little notebook if you want to look all artsy. The tool itself doesn't matter. I just suggest people actually try doing it.
Well, great. Well, Laura Vanderkam, thanks so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me.
My guest today was Laura Vanderkam. We discussed her book, Off the Clock. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. You can find out more information about her work at her website, lauravanderkam.com. Also, check out her podcast. She's got one called Before Breakfast and another one called Best of Both Worlds. Also, check out our show notes at aom.is/off the clock, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM podcast. Check out our website at artofmanliness.com where you can find all of our podcast archives. We got 490 there plus there. Also thousands of articles on just about anything, personal finances, fitness, how to be a better husband, better father, you name it, we've got it. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate it if you take 1 minute to give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. Helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member who you think would get something out of it. As always, thank you for the continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay reminding you not only listen to the AOM podcast, but put what you've heard into action. And one last thing before we go, we have an enrollment going on right now for strenuouslife.co. Strenuous Life is an online platform that we created to help you put into action all the things we've been writing about in Art of Manliness for the past 11 years and talking about on the podcast. We've got badges, we've got accountability for physical fitness, good deeds, and you get weekly challenges every single week. They're going to push you outside of your comfort zone. Enrollment closes April 4th. That's Thursday, or when we fill the 3 classes that we have enrolling this year. So it's whichever one comes first. So if you want to sign up early, because they usually fill pretty fast, so head to strenuouslife.co if you want to get on in this enrollment. If you don't, you're not ready yet, make sure to put your email on the waiting list so you can find out when our next enrollment opens up. Probably going to be in another 3 months. So strenuouslife.co, check it out. I hope to see you there.